Welcome, everybody, to the inaugural Figure Asset Management Investor Call. All references to Figure Asset Management are inclusive of its wholly owned subsidiary, Figure Investment Advisors. I'm Ben Borton, Managing Director of Figure Asset Management. I'm joined today by members of our investment team, including Mike Cagney, our CEO and Chair of the Investment Committee, and Dr. Michael Dooley, our Chief Economist. I'll do a brief introduction of Figure Asset Management and then turn it over to Mike and Dr. Dooley to discuss our current macro views, capital markets insights from the Provenance ecosystem, and implications for our world equity and REIT strategies. The goal of Figure Asset Management is to democratize access to high-performing alternative investments by leveraging the Provenance blockchain. For those of you who don't already know them, the members of our investment committee have collaborated for more than 15 years. Mike Cagney is well-known serial entrepreneur in fintech and asset management. Mike's the CEO of Figure Technologies and the chairman of Figure Asset Management Investment Committee. Mike was previously the founder and CEO of SoFi, founder and managing partner of Figure Asset Management predecessor firm, Cabazon Investment Group, and began his career as a prop trader at Wells Fargo. Dr. Michael Dooley is chief economist for Figure Asset Management and professor emeritus of economics at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He was a founding partner of Cabazon Investment Group and has collaborated with Mike Cagney for the past 15 years. Dr. Dooley spent more than 20 years working at the Federal Reserve and IMF and regularly advises on monetary policy matters. Bill White is the portfolio manager for our world equity and REIT strategies. During his career, Bill has been a portfolio manager for funds managed by Figure Asset Management's predecessor firm, as well as the Reflow Fund. He's been VP trading at SoFi, held various leadership roles with Reflow and Forward Management, and began his career at Morgan Stanley Online, where he headed equity options and fixed income trading at the San Francisco office. Figure leverages its position in the Provenance blockchain ecosystem for both insights and opportunities that drive our unique investment offerings. These include the world equity and REIT strategies. Figure World Equity is an actively managed equity index portfolio that seeks to outperform the FTSE Developed Index based on global macro research and insights derived from real-time visibility into capital markets activity on Provenance. We've run this strategy for more than a decade for a large family office and recently seeded a fund to make it available to outside investors on the Provenance marketplace. Strategies outperformed its FTSE Developed benchmark by close to 300 basis points annually on a net basis since 2007. Figure REIT, the first REIT entirely native to blockchain, will seek to outperform yield alternatives by investing in a portfolio of Figure HELOCs and related securitizations. Figure REIT replaces the opacity of traditional mortgage REITs, next level transparency made possible by blockchain. We think this structure will fundamentally shift how people think about mortgage REITs going forward. We're opening up to subscriptions on October 1st for a January 1 close. There's 25 million of initial capacity in the REIT that will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. The Figure Asset Management funds are available exclusively through the Provenance Marketplace, which allows for an end-to-end digital experience powered by blockchain. Accredited investors verify their status and can invest in a few easy steps. We encourage listeners to visit the Provenance Marketplace at provenance.io, become a member, and explore the marketplace. With that intro out of the way, let's jump in with Mike Cagney and Mike Dooley to discuss our latest macro views. Mike, can you set the context for us with a recap on recent macro events and our interpretation of those events?
Sure. So appreciate everyone who's joined us today. So basically, the way we're looking at the economy right now, you know, in the U.S., the PMI numbers that we're getting, which, you know, are diffusion indices, so we have to be careful about them, but they've been relatively strong across services and manufacturing. We're, you know, in the mid-50 handle across both indices, and I think, as many of you know, anything over 50 is expansionary, anything under 50 is contraction, and so it foots with the whole concept of the U.S. slowly reopening. Sometimes in California and New York City, we can lose the view that it is reopening and get a little myopic, but the reality is that the country is slowly reopening. We're seeing that on the PMI numbers. We're seeing that on both new claims and continuing claims. And it, you know, it's supportive of some economic growth. Europe looks a little bit different. You know, their PMI numbers are coming in, the most recent ones, in a 47 handle, so still contracting. And you know, they're running significant uptick in COVID cases, and you know, there's a lot of concern about a second shutdown, but it's not clear they ever came out of the first shutdown. And so, you know, you've got this interesting dichotomy between Europe and the U.S. Japan also is similar to Europe in that its diffusion indices are 47, so it's contracting. And so it's, you know, within the global standpoint in terms of where growth is happening, you know, the U.S. is growing, and you know, the nowcast, the Atlanta Fed, is forecasting 32% GDP in in this quarter, Q3. We have to remember that we were down 34.3% in Q2. So, you know, these things aren't cumulative, they're geometric. So we need a 52% rebound in GDP to get back to where we were before the COVID crisis hit. But directionally, the U.S. is growing. And I think that's, you know, an important dynamic as we think about how we look at allocation across the world, that, you know, the U.S., you know, ignoring valuation metrics for a second, is where you're getting growth. And it kind of ties into this whole concept of the Fed being at zero for a long period of time. And, you know, as we all know, the value of an equity is simply the discounted value of its earnings. And discounting anything at zero asymptotically goes to infinity. And so, you know, there's a significant policy support for risk assets that's happening over the medium to long term. The more relevant issue right now from a tactical allocation standpoint is we're really very, very reliant on stimulus and support into the economy. We saw that on the initial PPP loan program, Main Street loan program, supplemental unemployment insurance benefits. You know, I think some of you might have read the blog that I put out a couple of weeks back, where in, I think, 42 out of 50 states, you were better off as a median worker being unemployed than employed in terms of what you were getting as both unemployment insurance and the supplemental benefits. Those benefits have not been extended. And the biggest challenge that I think we have near term is we knew this was going to be a contested election, or we felt this would be a contested election. I shouldn't say we know because it hasn't happened yet, but we felt this would be a contested election, which, you know, generally is not a bullish support for risk assets. You know, there's a lot of concern. That dynamic on the election got significantly more important with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's vacancy at the Supreme Court and her unfortunate passing. And so, you know, we think you're looking at a very difficult political environment where it's highly unlikely we're going to get any cohesive stimulus passed through while these two sides are at loggerheads. And, you know, if you've been watching the market today, you know, you could say that some of the sell-off that's happening, you know, that started happening about an hour ago is coming on the back of, you know, new clusters of cases in New York City and so forth. That's not really what's driving. And I think there's always an expectation that as we were going back to school and you know, starting to reopen, we would get new emergences of COVID cases. It was, you know, in my mind that the Fed came out and said, we need stimulus. And we can keep rates at zero forever, but without stimulus, we're going to have some real significant challenges. And you know, I don't see where there's a cohesive bipartisan effort to get or solution to get any stimulus through, you know, leading into the election and most likely for months after, as it will likely be contested. And so, you know, from a tactical standpoint, we've taken that into consideration. We're underweight our index right now, and you know, looking at today, I wish I was even more underweight, but. But, you know, we see the near term challenges really being the election dynamic and the lack of any stimulus progress while this is unfolding. But the medium to long term is still supportive on risk assets, given, you know, the Fed's commitment to a zero or near zero rate environment for, you know, what seems to be a perpetual future. I was either famous or infamous in 2008 saying the Fed would never raise rates again in my lifetime. And they ended up raising rates once, and it was a mistake, and they reversed course. So they shouldn't have. But I feel kind of the same way right now, and it's a longer discussion that we can have, and maybe, you know, Dr. Dooley will touch a little bit on this. But you know, we see a very low rate environment persisting for a very long time. One other thing that makes me considerably concerned around the stimulus side is if you look at where cash was coming from in the first half of this year, a lot of people were benefiting significantly from the unemployment supplemental benefits, but we also had a massive mortgage refinancing boom where people were unlocking equity that was trapped in their home, significantly creating cash. And what I'm a little concerned about is if you look at some of the web impressions in terms of refi search hits, you see a massive spike in Q1, Q2. and especially in Q2, relative to, you know, where we were in 2019, 2018. But more recently, that's come down precipitously. In fact, search term and search impressions for refi, mortgage refi, are now below where they were at the same point last year. And so I think one thing to keep in mind is this significant refi boom that was putting a lot of cash into the hands of consumers and supporting spending, especially in a circumstance where incomes might have been curtailed, you know, that is slowing down as well. That could be offset by the massive increase in savings that we had over the first 6 months of the year. And so there could be a dis-savings to offset that somewhat. But it's something to keep in mind, and I think really underscores the need for incremental stimulus to keep the economy above zero as we go into Q4. But again, you know, I'm not optimistic such stimulus is going to manifest. So Dr. Dooley, I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I'm going to do a little bit of history. I think Mike's done a nice job of bringing us up to date. My purpose in this is just to give you some background of how sort of the deep, well, I don't want to say it's not all that deep, but the deep thinking behind our current analysis. As many of you may remember, we were associated with the so-called Bretton Woods II system, or the hypothesis that got China into the game and dominated really macro thinking, in my opinion, for the last 15 years. What BW2 was a temporary, but pretty long, but it lasted almost a decade, political consensus that allowed China to join the world. The implicit deal was that the U.S. and other industrial countries opened their markets, enjoyed cheap goods, and a little less obviously also enjoyed very cheap financing of those goods. The massive accumulation of dollar assets by the Chinese government more than financed all of the purchases of goods that we made from China and other emerging markets for almost 15 years. That consensus was unusual in the sense, historically unusual, because normally people for a long time had argued that the way for emerging markets, China and other emerging markets, to develop rapidly was to move into manufacturing where productivity was high and where they had the advantage of cheap labor. The problem was everyone assumed that the industrial countries would block that in order to protect their own labor force. And in fact, what we saw over this time period was that the real losers in this, the winners were U.S. consumers, obviously from cheap goods. U.S. investors, the massive capital inflow kept interest rates, real interest rates in particular, low throughout this time period. But the clear loser was U.S. labor. Why did it last as long as it did? It's a really interesting political question. Our answer to that is that the either by accident or on purpose, China allowed U.S. firms to participate in the boom by allowing direct investment and, in fact, encouraging direct investment into China and other emerging markets. They shared the U.S. companies, firms shared in the boom and shared in the rewards for using cheap labor, to be blunt about it, replacing expensive labor in the U.S. and other industrial countries with cheap labor in China, and making really very substantial profits. We're still feeling, well, in this game, labor, which was already suffering because of deunionization and technological change, replacing labor, were really ineffective for a surprisingly long time. But that era is now over. And so our shorthand for that is BW2, as we, that system as we knew it, is now dead. Donald Trump gets credit for his China policies, but we think he's more of a symptom than a a cause of this. The fact is that U.S. labor and labor in all the other industrial countries has now organized and is extremely powerful political movement, and that this has already started to, but will stop the whole movement toward globalization. That movement toward globalization, the movement away from globalization, we think, will really dominate and condition interpretation of macroeconomics for the next 10 years. Those that get this right will do relatively well. Those that do it incorrectly or don't recognize that it's going on will do relatively badly. To give a very, very, very brief view of what we think of this is that trade and trade in goods and services, and more importantly, maybe trade in financial assets, capital, will be increasingly interfered with by governments in order to protect their own labor forces. It follows, we think, that countries that are dependent on international trade for growth will do relatively badly, relative to countries like the United States, which is largely a large closed economy. Emerging markets will be particularly vulnerable, I think. We once argued that after China became a more mature industrial power, that India would be the next in line, and maybe Indonesia would be the next in line after them to follow this export-led growth policy. I think that is now dead for the foreseeable future. One interesting question is you might argue that, well, this will be particularly bad for China. Well, maybe not. It may be that they have been in the game for long enough now and successful enough now so that they can continue to expand without the artificial push from export-led growth. That's one of the calls, which one of the things we're going to be monitoring very carefully, and one of the things which will I think will shape the investment climate for many years to come. So when I hand it back to Mike or Ben.
Mike, you published over the summer on the impact of fiscal stimulus in the U.S., and you talked a bit about this in opening. Can you walk us through your views on where we are today with that and what our expectations are going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I hit on this in the summary, which is the government, when COVID hit, they did a pretty good job building a very robust fiscal safety net through the unemployment, supplemental unemployment insurance and through PPP. And the idea was that this was going to be a 2 to 3 month transitory event, and that we would find ourselves out of COVID in, call it June. And of course, that's not what happened. And so the stimulus has continued to some extent through to August and September. But effectively what the government's doing is they're building a bridge, and it's the challenge of building a bridge is if you don't see the other side of the bank, you don't know how long you got to build the bridge for. And there's always the issue about what there's certainly the MTM theory that says that a government can indebt itself indefinitely without any repercussions. That's not true. At some point there's repercussions. There just haven't been yet. I think the government still has plenty of dry powder to be able to extend stimulus. I think all the discussions about debt levels being the highest since World War II, in a zero rate environment that doesn't matter. In an inflationary environment that becomes a very different dynamic. And I've long made fun of my colleagues who have engaged in the short JGB trade, on the expectation that their debt load was unsustainable. But you can sustain a lot of debt at zero interest rates, and you can sustain even more at negative rates. And so, it's imperative that in the near term, it's imperative to have a positive Q4 for some kind of stimulus to be reached and delivered. But again, I don't see that happening. So what I see is, a, a, significant rebound in Q3. I think Atlanta Fed is right that it is in a 30 handle in terms of GDP growth. As I said, that doesn't get us back to where we were, because we need about 55% growth rate to get back to the 34% we lost. I think we're at risk of having a negative Q4 and, a double dip from an economic standpoint.
Dr. Dooley, you have deep ties to the monetary policy community. What are you seeing from the Fed right now?
Yeah, I think their recent statement or the changing their operating policies is represents a very important shift in how the Fed looks at the world and how they see their role in the world. Some of the more interesting things I think are buried in the commentary, but a couple that really stuck out for me was that they said that it is a fact, but it's still important that they said it, is that expansions used to be stopped by monetary policy. When we had an inflationary shock, the Fed would react to that, would raise interest rates, and the classic recession is caused by first the inflationary shock and then the Fed reaction. And they point out, obviously, the last two expansions were stopped by financial instability, not by financial problems in the financial markets, not by problems in the, not by an inflationary shock to prices of goods and services. What that means is that the whole kind of enterprise of Fed watching has to kind of shift. That what they're now looking for, in to the extent that they contrary to Mike's view, if they ever raise rates again, or they ever take significant policy actions again, it will be because they see imbalances and vulnerabilities in the financial system, over leveraging in some important part of the economy. We don't see that yet, but I think that's a really important change to how they see the world. Equally important, because of they now view income distribution in the U.S. as a major problem, that moving the economy to or even past full employment, they argue, does help the low income part of the wage spectrum. And therefore it's just fine from an income distribution point of view to operate near or even past full what we used to think of as full employment. That means that alone means a much more expansionary Fed than the one that I worked in many years ago. On top of that, institutionally, they would just love to have to reinstate the federal funds rate as an effective policy tool. And the only way you're going to do that is with higher inflation rates, higher nominal interest rates. The Fed can't do anything about low real interest rates. I think that's out of their control, at least in the long run. But they can, if they get the inflation rate up above 2-3%, then nominal interest rates will be incorporated in nominal rates. And then the federal funds rate will again become, hopefully, a powerful policy tool. And so when they say they're determined that they won't react quickly if inflation starts to creep up, I think they mean it, that they will continue to push on the economy for much longer than they would have in the past. What this means to me is that given the lack of confidence that I or anybody else or the Federal Reserve has in their ability to actually increase the inflation rate, I mean, they can't. They've been creating money as fast as anyone could ever imagine creating money. It has not done it. My guess is that they're going to remain very expansionary for a very long time, unless they see a situation in which a major financial sector of the U.S. or world financial markets, but more likely U.S. financial markets, has gone past the point where it'll cause a financial panic. So what this means, this I think offers some really interesting and important challenges for analysts to kind of switch your whole back, your whole, what you all, everything you've learned about monetary policy is probably wrong. The Fed can't easily move the inflation rate up and down the way it wants to. It's trying to do that by changing expectations, but that's a uncharted territory. Nobody knows, no one, including themselves, know whether that will work or not. So it's hard for me to imagine a situation just from the macro side of the economy where they will raise rates for the foreseeable future. And by foreseeable, I mean years, not months. On the other hand, look out for financial instability. And they are talking about it and they're reporting on it. So you look at the Fed minutes or you look at the Federal Reserve publications, you can see that where they're monitoring financial vulnerabilities and where and how they might react to them. So I think it's a new ball game for the Fed. Maybe for those of us who worked there a long time ago, our human capital is depreciated. But for me, it's really fun to try to figure out how they're going to behave in this brave new world.
Mike, Dr. Dooley has laid out a case for low interest rates for the foreseeable future. What do you think that means for equity markets?
Yeah, so I think to Dr. Dooley's point, I feel that I was defrauded in my economic education because everything I was taught hasn't manifested. So, and you know, reinforce what he said.
Excuse me, Michael. I was a part of that education.
I know. And to reinforce, you know, what he said, I remember in 2008, we went to the San Francisco Fed, and at the time, Janet Yellen was the regional governor. And, you know, her thing was, you can deal with inflation, you can never, it's we've never been able to get out of deflation other than through war. And that really stuck to me about the asymmetry of how the Fed looks at these risks. And you know, this is not the Volcker Fed that Dr. Dooley was involved in. You know, this is a Fed that's, you know, views inflation as a significant, as a way that, something they can manage with tools, but deflation is a significant policy risk that, you know, they don't have a roadmap to get out of. And Japan's being completely unsuccessful, although Japan has demographic headwinds that they deal with in terms of the deflation there. But, you know, no amount of monetary policy has created inflation in Japan. And so, yeah, I think that you know, the one nuance to this is there is inflation happening, but it's asset inflation. It's not goods and services inflation. And the Fed is exacerbating that by doing things like, you know, providing backstop to industrial grade corporate loans, industrial grade corporate bonds, buying bonds in open market, or even threatening to do it, which is really what they've done. They haven't bought them, they threaten to buy them. And this is crazy and unprecedented. I mean, it makes this stuff that happened in 2008 look pedestrian. And even, and, you know, when it happened in 2008, we were all in shock and awe, right? And so, you know, I always joke with Dr. Dooley that I think the Fed's adopted a third mandate, which is holding up the equity market. And, you know, he would disagree with me, but, you know, I think even if you say on a second order basis that if the equity market collapses and that tightens financial conditions, that threatens their first two mandates, which is full employment and price stability. You know, their actions certainly suggest that they're focused on that market. And what they've done is they've created kind of the have and the have nots, right? So if you're an investment grade corporate issuer, you're in phenomenal situation having a Fed backstop. If you're, you know, a subprime issuer or a resi backed mortgage issuer where there is no government TALF or backstop, Fed backstop program, you got a whole world of hurt and experience that over the second quarter. So, and I think, you know, what this manifests to is, you know, this is not a value investor market as much as my value investor friends wish it was. This is, you know, with zero interest rates and, you know, again, going back to the paradigm of all stocks are the present value of earnings and present value of something at zero gets you close to infinity. You know, you pay out for earnings and this is, you know, this coupled with the online nature of, you know, a lot of the technology stocks explains a lot of the run up in tech. I know a lot of people would like to think it was SoftBank buying call options, but you know, we can talk about market dynamics and why that's not the case. And so, you know, again, over the medium to long term, we would expect that the large cap, mega cap, and especially mega cap tech is going to continue to outperform. Over the near term, you know, against the headwinds that we have, it's going to be disproportionately hit because that's what people have made money on. They're going to take their money out. And so, you know, it leads into how we think about market, which we'll talk about in a moment from an allocation standpoint. But, you know, the Fed has definitely set the stage to benefit the mega caps. And you know, this is why you've seen the massive underperformance in the Russell versus the NASD or the S&P.
What about the dollar? Do we think there's any risk to its status as a reserve currency?
Well, not now, because all the commodities are dollar denominated. And you know, one of the discussions we have with the dollar, it's you know, whenever I talk to macro managers, you know, one of their favorite discussions is about where they're going to move, what country they're going to flee to. And it's kind of analogous to, you know, what currency are you going to go to? Because if you get out of the dollar, you got to buy something. And, you know, some people have bought gold, they've done well. Some people have bought Bitcoin, they've done well. You know, our issue is, like, you know, for the reasons I cited at the beginning of this conversation, I don't know why I'd want to rush into the euro. I don't know why I'd want to rush into the yen. You know, I'd buy growth, and you know, the US is where the growth is. So everyone likes to talk about the dollar collapse or the dollar demise. I just, you know, I don't know what you buy. And you know, in the context of central bank reserves, with commodities being dollar denominated, until that changes, you're going to have to hold dollars. I think, you know, obviously we're very close to folks because of our blockchain involvement on the crypto side, and you know, this is a Bitcoin's champion market environment right now, because they would say buy Bitcoin. That's a whole different risky paradigm. Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's not what we do. So we, you know, we focus on fiat currency. And I think in general, we're comfortable being long the dollar. We do have some yen position because we think there's some asymmetry in how the yen performs on up down market. But, you know, in general, we're okay long dollar here.
And Mike, given our central position in the provenance ecosystem, we get some really interesting real-time data from the consumer credit markets. Can you talk a little bit about what we're seeing from that side and how that interplays with some of the macro thinking that we've talked about thus far?
Yeah, and it's a combination of our lending business and what happens on blockchain, because we're, you know, obviously we can't look at other people's stuff on blockchain, but we can look at our own stuff. And yeah, you know, one of the things that we do on our lending business is we have real-time servicing. So I know as of 12/38 today how many loans have paid me that should have paid me. And if you compare that to the normal mortgage market, where it takes you at least 30 days to get a remittance report, it gives you much more timely data. And you know, what we saw in the initial COVID scare was, you know, our stuff still performed. We had some elevation in delinquency and forbearance, but you know, in general, it was still paying. And actually, we, you know, there were other funds that were buying our paper to front run mortgage market because they had better visibility to performance. You know, what we're seeing right now is basically the delinquency rates have dropped precipitously to sort of, you know, to basically pre-COVID levels. So you know, they're at least today, there, you know, it looks like the consumer is back on level footing. And I think this reflects to, you know, the general reopening in the country and the improvement we've seen on the PMIs and the diffusion indices. But again, I caution, you know, looking into the lack of stimulus, Q4 could be bumpy before we get, you know, to the other side of this. And you know, the other side of this, I think, is very virtuous for risk assets. And I think it's virtuous for the economy. But we might have a quarter that's going to be a little disruptive. But you know, our real-time stuff, yeah, I can tell you, 60-day delinquencies are you know, at pre-COVID levels today.
And switching gears, Mike, can you walk us through how some of these insights are filtering into our world equity and REIT strategies today and influencing our allocations?
Yeah, I mean, so in the context of the global allocation, you know, as I said, we're not bullish on Europe or Japan right now, so we're effectively zero weight in both. We don't have the conviction to be short either yet, but we're zero weight on both from an allocation standpoint, meaning we're overweight in the US. Within the US, we're overweight NASDAQ, but we're underweight the overall allocation. So we own the NASDAQ, but we own, you know, we're less than 100% allocated. And, you know, we made that revision again, looking forward into the end of year election. And, you know, we might come further down in terms of allocation. You know, we were hoping yesterday's rally would give us a better selling point. It didn't materialize the way that we wanted it to. But, you know, we're under allocated from an equity standpoint right now, but where we are allocated is in the US and, you know, predominantly, you know, within the NASDAQ because of the growth story that's there. We have a small allocation to China A shares, which, you know, we think has a bunch of dynamics related to, you know, outperforming where we see Japan outperforming, you know, with some correlation to Europe. And so the zero weights in Europe, we can somewhat mitigate that. But also, you know, the Chinese recovery has actually been very interesting to watch. And you always have to be suspect of the data that comes out there in terms of what's true and what's manufactured. But you know, the directional resumption of economic activity seems to correlate with the resumption of global trade, and those global trade numbers are harder to fake. And so, you know, we think that there is recovery happening there, and there's a government that's very focused on creating an asymmetric backdrop for risk assets. So, you know, we're comfortable having that position. And then we have, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a small position in Japanese yen because we see that performing very asymmetrically, that it does not sell off on rallies, but it does tend to rally pretty strong on sell-offs. And so, you know, we like that asymmetry just in terms of portfolio insurance. So that's where we are on world equity. And then, you know, one of the things that Ben mentioned, we're launching a REIT strategy and, you know, called Figure REIT. And our motivation in doing this is we're seeing very strong performance on the REITs that are on the HELOCs that we're originating. And, you know, one of the challenges that hit the REITs in Q2 was they didn't have committed financing. And so all their warehouse providers were calling up, remarking their collateral, pulling their credit lines. Our financing on this REIT vehicle is committed financing. So it's a four-year facility where, you know, there is no mark-to-market provision. So, you know, we have the ability to ensure constant leverage and not have a fire sale of assets. And so, you know, given the very low rate environment and the relatively high yielding HELOCs we're originating, given the committed financing, we felt it made sense to put that in motion. And so, you know, we're excited to get that launched and get moving on that front too.
And can you talk a little bit about the HELOC market opportunity in general, kind of how that's played out since the global financial crisis, where we see as the market opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, it's really the way that we position HELOC is as an alternative to unsecured consumer. And so there's a very virtuous credit signaling that if you were going to get an unsecured loan at 13, but you can get a, you know, a HELOC from me at 8 in the same time period, and, you know, with the same effort, if you take the 13, that says something about your conviction on being able to pay that debt back. So, you know, one of the reasons why we've outperformed, and, you know, if you look at our HELOC credit over the COVID process, you know, we were inside of Fannie Mae first lien mortgage on both forbearance and delinquency through the whole process. And so, you know, our second liens and third liens have outperformed first liens, in part because of that virtuous credit signaling that comes out of the origination process. And so, you know, what we've done is we have a 5-minute HELOC process. It's very painless, and you know, it's opened up that market opportunity. As rates level off and if they ever go back up, you know, there's a huge opportunity to expand application of that because people want to keep their low mortgage rates as they want to untap equity in their home. But, you know, that's more of a 2021, 22 story than it is a story today.
I want to open it up to questions from the audience. If you want to put some questions into the GoToWebinar console, please put those in. And Mike will be happy to field those. While we're waiting on those, I'll put some closing remarks on the two strategies. We've run the Figure World Equity Strategy for a large family office since 2007. At the beginning of September, we seeded the World Equity Fund on the Provenance Marketplace and are opening up to outside capital for the first time in many years on October 1. So this is a strategy based on the global macro insights that you've heard talked about today, as well as the insights that are kind of filtering up from the real-time information that we get from the Provenance ecosystem. It's outperformed its FTSE benchmark by close to 300 basis points on a net basis since inception. The Figure REIT is the first blockchain native mortgage REIT. The REIT is going to be custodied and administered on Provenance blockchain, and it's going to invest in a portfolio of Figure HELOCs that were originated on Provenance. And investors are going to have unparalleled real-time transparency into the underlying portfolio of loans held by the REIT. I mean, Mike mentioned some of that real-time information. That's going to pass through to investors in the REIT, and that's very different from kind of traditional mortgage REITs. So Figure REIT is being seeded with a portfolio of Figure HELOCs, and we'll begin accepting subscriptions October 1 for a January 1 closing. We have about $25 million of capacity for this first raise on a first come, first serve basis. For people who are interested in these two funds, we would encourage you to visit the Provenance Marketplace at provenance.io. If you have any questions, please reach out to me. My contact details are in the webinar portal. You can get me at bborton@figureinvest.com. We'd encourage you to read blog posts from both Mike Cagney and Dr. Dooley on the newly launched Figure Asset Management page at figure.com/asset-management. A replay of this call will be made available on the website, and stay tuned for details on our next investor call. We're targeting a quarterly cadence for these calls. Let's see if we're getting any questions from the audience. Here's one. Mike, can you share a bit more about what makes the REIT and World Equity Fund so unique?
Well, I think with World Equity, you know, we take a unique investment approach in the context of a top-down macro. You know, it's not a bottom-up stock selection. And I think in the market environment that we're in, the one that we've been in, that's you know, more of what's driving market behavior. It's central bank activity, it's government policy activity. And I think, you know, just with Dr. Dooley's background and our experience trading against those markets or in those markets, you know, we're well positioned to deliver some consistent outperformance, as you mentioned, as we've done since we've been running it back in 2007. You know, the fact that it's on blockchain, I think, is obviously innovative in the sense that we're custodying on blockchain, providing the ability to raise capital through blockchain. So, you know, even if you don't want to subscribe into the REIT or to World Equity, go to provenance.io and just go through the investor accreditation confirmation process, which you only have to do once for, you know, no matter how many funds you subsequently invest in. You know, I think it's a really elegant way to, you know, kind of, as you mentioned earlier, democratize access to these kinds of investments in a scalable way. And you know, downstream, what you'll have, you know, with World Equity, it's not so much relevant because you have, you know, pretty significant liquidity there, but you have the ability to trade your fund interest as well in a secondary market. And on the REIT side, you know, it's really taking advantage of Figure's ability to create assets at relatively high yield with really good credit, you know, what I would consider virtuous credit signaling and strong underwriting. And, you know, getting a committed financing vehicle in there is unique in REIT universe, so that you have good predictability and visibility on your return profile. And again, all the benefits of Provenance in terms of real-time custody, real-time visibility of the performance of the assets, and, you know, very quick, very soon, not today, but very soon, a secondary market to trade your shares through. Ben, you're silent. So,
with that, I think we're going to wrap it up. Thanks for joining us today, everybody. As mentioned, stay tuned for details on our next investor call. We're hoping to do this on a quarterly cadence. If you have questions following on as you've kind of processed some of this information, feel free to reach out to me. Feel free to send questions in that we should address in future calls. And we look forward to hearing from all of you. Thanks so much for attending.